So it's not just apostates who are in danger.
No,
it's the one intelligent guy that merged that rose out of the herd and just didn't want to swim in pig shit anymore. You know what I'm saying? And the rest of the pigs said, "How dare you clean yourself off?" You know, doesn't that sound like a certain guy that was censured some time back? You know, by a
but
bunch
also,
of pigs.
Again, remember the speech from Howard Roark and Ayn Rand, where he said the guy who invented fire was probably burned at the stake using his own invention.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody appreciates a genius. They want to shoot him. They'll love his work later on.
Then there's Tesla, who said, actually, it's on a movie that he said it, but it's very profound. He said, man's reach exceeds his grasp. And he said, after he made his first invention, he won a Nobel Prize. After his second invention, he was politely asked to retire. You know, several hundred inventions later, Tesla's people were running a smear campaign. Not Tesla's, Edison's people were running a smear campaign against him, and he was eventually shut down.
Yeah.
That's from the movie The Prestige, right?
Exactly, yeah. But if you research Tesla, I can't think of an inventor who's produced more inventions in one lifetime and so many profound inventions. From machines that can produce earthquakes to, you know, remote control boat back in the 1930s to the first electric car that used a remote control power receiver, wireless electricity, et cetera, et cetera. And the people just couldn't make any sense out of what he was producing, and nobody used any of the technology until much later.
I only really knew him up until now for the Tesla coil.
Yeah, he produced, he came up with one invention. It was called death rays. His proposal for world peace was to invent these death rays that he was designing, which would be capable of decimating entire cities and give the designs to every country in the world so that the fear of mutual destruction would force us to develop a global community.
Oh.
Of course, that's the logic behind nuclear weapons today, isn't it?
He also discredits Einstein as ripping off a previous philosopher who developed relativity theory maybe 20 or 40 years before Einstein.
Okay.
Yeah, and he also argues with Einstein's theory of space being able to be curved. Tesla actually believed in an ether.
Well, I mean, Nietzsche says God is dead because, again, that vertical idea of God, the external God who's up there with the sun that the Pope climbs up the mountain to listen to and then comes down from the mountain and tells all his cardinals and bishops to talk to mom and dad, that's gone. I mean, the only way to get somebody to buy that crap anymore is you got to start conditioning them from childhood, and they've got to just not find it really terribly important. You listen to most people in the crisis communities today, and religion is about nothing but morals. It's all about making you a nice person, and God is nothing but a fearsome object to compel you to behave.
So it's religion today is if just like got you right there. So religion today is all about making you into a nice person more than making you into a creative person or a creator.
Exactly. Nice people do what they're told. They wash their hands before dinner and they don't speak when spoken to and they go to bed on time.
I have a comment on creativity.
Go ahead, Cammy.
Ryan was talking about the Arab boy, the student that was killed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is something that I'm kind of seeing. There's this one guy that I've been in a lot of contact with. He's an apostate, and he got asylum in Switzerland. And he writes a lot about what's going on in Muslim countries with the apostates being in danger and so on.
Uh-huh.
And he's also a really wonderful poet, and he stopped publishing his poems on his blog, so he only has you know, basically the articles about Muslims on there. And it's really kind of sad because he said, no, because it has nothing to do with my cause. And this is another thing. It's that in the Muslim world, it's against Islam, basically, to draw images of people. And the way that some creative people try to get around that is with words, with poetry.
I know they can't draw pictures of Muhammad, but they can't draw pictures of even other people.
I don't think so, no.
Wild, I didn't know that.
It's funny, I've never seen any... It's funny, I have never seen any paintings or caricatures of people, really, when I've been in Arabic villages. You might see really beautiful...
landscape.
Like, landscapes or really beautiful designs, like embroideries and, you know, architecture. But you'll never see, or at least it's extremely uncommon, to see carvings of people or any anthropomorphic images. Yeah. I never knew about it.
Yeah, I wonder what the reason for that is. I mean, because you almost want to say they understand that all men are divine, and if you can't draw pictures of God, because you'll have no false idols, you know what I'm saying? It would make sense.
Yeah, well, from what I'm understanding, and this isn't from Arabic sources, it's more from Israelis that critique the Muslim mentality. They say that the reason they live like this is because they just value the transcendent. They don't value the material at all. And it's hard to argue with it, because when you go to not only Arabic villages in Israel, but also, you know, Arab countries like Egypt, it looks like shit most of the place, you know. And their houses, the inside will be very beautiful, though. It's traditionally Arabs will make the inside of their home sparkling, clean, and extremely beautiful. But the outside of everything, just they leave it to go to shit. And this really suggests valuing the internal and the untangible, that which isn't externalized, and having no value at all for anything that's external, or what we would call objective in the material sense.
Well, as we've spoken on the list before, there's three kinds of cultures: material, spiritual, and integrated. Your crisis cultures, Arab, Islamic, Judaic, Christian, these cultures are spiritual cultures. They find the material universe to be evil, ugly, dirty, all these things. And they espouse the spiritual over this world. Of course, the materialists are just the opposite. They don't see any reality in that which the senses can't comprehend. And then, of course, we who are in Thelema are an integral world where we find this world to be as valuable as the spiritual world. So it's no wonder that the Arabics, the Islamics, even the Jews and the Christians behave like this. And in Christian culture, we have our pollution and everything else where we just dump, you know, let's just harvest nature any which way we can and wait for the rapture.
Well, the Jewish culture is really tricky to understand because culturally they value the material world exceedingly.
Which gets them in trouble.
They're obsessed. They're obsessed with perfection and with being clever, so much that it gets annoying sometimes. I mean, you can't just relax. They'll poke at something on you because it's out of place, you know. You need to fix that, you need to fix this. And yet, the religious Jews are just similar, very similar to the Muslims in that, you know, they won't drive cars, they'll just walk everywhere. I mean, the extreme religious Jews. So you have these two extremes within the culture. But the mainstream culture is extremely materialistic.
Well, yes, because that mainstream culture doesn't believe in an afterlife.
Exactly.
It's just clear that, you know? So yeah. This is the real and only universe for them.
Yeah.
And that's
which explains their earnestness. Everything is super serious for them. And the only way you could really explain that is, if this is the only life you live in, everything must be really earnest, because this is all they have.
Yes.
I never thought of it that way, as far as why they're so, I guess, thrifty.
Tense and jumpy, you know, and arguing so easily about the smallest things.
Yeah. The reliance on now, I think, is a fantabulous thing. And of course, if we look at Kabbalistic culture with inside of Judaism, because there is a debate on whether or not there is an afterlife. There is a debate that's been going for thousands of years within Jewish culture on whether there are angels, etc.
That's the interesting thing. There's this this real paradox. But at least exoterically speaking, they don't express much room for an afterlife. But it's like secretly, when nobody's they toy with the idea.
When nobody's looking.
Well, I'm using that metaphorically speaking. You know what I mean?
If you look back into Christian times and you look at the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, I forget which was which, but the one was arguing for angels, afterlife, all this kind of stuff, and the other was arguing vehemently against it.
Yeah, well, you have also the Pharisees, from which Rabbinic Judaism evolved, and then you have the Sadducees, and a major debate took place between them probably around just before the time of Christ, assuming he existed, of course. So to be even more accurate, just before around the time of the Essenes, and just after the Hellenistic period, and definitely during the Roman period, you have the Sadducees, which basically interpreted the Torah word for word, or claimed to do so. And then you have Pharisaic Judaism, which says, no, there's an oral tradition of interpretation and exegesis and debate. And it's from this that you get the Talmud and eventually the Midrash and the Mishnah written down. So it's within this tradition that you get the room and what I call the menu, the philosophical menu, where the idea of an afterlife can even be discussed. Where with the Sadducees, I'm imagining it would have been a very different story.
Yeah, well, certainly I think I know from speaking with, contemporary Jews today and the more Orthodox and Hasidic, that there is debate in the community over whether or not all these other, commonly called supernatural ideas exist. You know, is there an afterlife? Are there angels? Are there higher levels and hierarchies of beings such as the Kabbalah suggests to us? That's a living thing that seems to be a permanent part of their tradition.
Well, Jews are also known stereotypically as always asking questions. There's always that joke of the Christian who goes to the rabbi and says, "Rabbi, is it true that Christians always answer questions with questions?" And the rabbi says, "Why would you ask such a thing?" I tell this to Jews, and they laugh at it just as hard, and they admit that it's true.
That's awesome.
Now, I remember watching a documentary where there's an agnostic traveling all over the world and talking to all different religious groups and sharing his lack of faith. And he was talking to some religious Jews. I don't know which sect they were from. And he said, "I have doubt. I don't know, and I don't really understand. I just have questions." And the rabbi said to him, "Well, if you're not sure and you doubt, you're definitely in the right place." That was his answer to him. So it seems like they value questioning and debate as a good in and of itself. That the process of dialogue is really for me, it seems that seems to be what they really value. It's an ongoing dialogue.
A dear old friend of mine who died back when I was in college turned me on to the idea of anarchism. And the philosophy was this. It's not the answers, it's the questions that matter.
Yeah.
When we learn to ask the right questions, we can improve our circumstances. We can improve society.
This is pretty much the attitude of the Jewish mentality, and the good part of it that I like. There's a whole negative side that I won't go into here. But, yeah, Paul, this is the good part that's really interesting.
So, Paul, responding to your statement there with the questions, that philosophy is about good questions rather than answers, that's the reason we're here, asking the question about why it is important with neurosis. Basically.
Yeah, but of course we're attempting to answer that. So we're starting to sound like we know what we're talking about.
Well, I think we did when we talked about the practical things it can give, and then also it being an end in of itself for the joy and love. And that
exactly.
And the practical things are a side product of that joy.
The perspective I get listening to all this, and we're talking about different cultures and different religions, it's like I'm getting the thought that, because I'm looking at the text here from the first book of book four, it says that meditation is the way of attainment of genius, and I'm just thinking maybe genius is kind of related to the word gnosis in that sense.
Absolutely.
I'll corroborate that, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, a culture, this culture, Thelema, as I've understood it, is about just that, learning to create your own genius. And
I think when you start to look at the fact that we are all gods, essentially, then we are all geniuses, each in our own way. The question is, can we bring that out in some way that's constructive, erstwhile, that helps us to interact with each other yet that much better?
I mean, creation of a culture that supports the creation of the personal genius in every individual, that's something fantastic. In my point of view,
start honoring everybody as gods, you're demanding genius of everyone.
When it comes to the fear of death, I like the Buddhist practice where you basically actively meditate upon your own death, or your fear of death, rather, because what I'm noticing is that there are either groups of people. You have the extremes, basically. You have a group of atheists who are like, nope, there's no afterlife, and all mythology is just a bunch of fairy tales. And on the other hand, you have pagans who are saying, like, yeah, there is an afterlife, and, of course, the other religious people. But I think it has to do with the fear of death, mostly. I mean, I don't know what to say exactly on the concept of the afterlife, except that mythology is taken literally too much, or literally interpretation.
Well, and I'll just interject real fast and say that Liber HHH for the Thelemite also asks him or her to contemplate his own death, or her own death.
Yes.
Good, right, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, you may find it humorous. I find it humorous. My dad had a temporary death experience when he was getting his heart scanned because he was suffering from heart problems, and they didn't know that he was allergic to the dye that they injected into him.
Oh, wow.
And he went into cardiac arrest, and he told me he was technically dead for a few minutes.
Mm.
And he told me being dead is boring. He says he said he didn't see any white light, he didn't see any angels. He said it just hurt a lot, like hell, and then all of a sudden everything's black and you're gone. And then all of a sudden he was there again, and in the room, and alive again.
But you never hear about that. The ones you hear about, you know, like you said, the ones seeing the white light and the dead people of their the relatives that have gone before.
Well, the white light sells books, remember, you know?
The interesting thing is my dad, he was a Christian. He quit the Catholic Church, though. But he reads a lot and he prays regularly. But he was being perfectly honest about what he perceived when he was technically dead. And he says, this is just
nothing.
A rare benefit these days, somebody being perfectly honest. You could have written a book and made millions.
That's what I told him. I said, if you just make up some bullshit, you could be a celebrity.
Be the guru of the week. You know, Oprah will have you on her show. You know, I was fat, now I'm skinny, you see? Thank Jesus.
But I think it's a personal experience, whatever it is that we go through when we die. Just like when we dream, I mean, a very powerful trauma is happening to the body. And personally, I don't feel it's my place or anybody's place to tell us in an authoritative manner what happens or doesn't happen after death. I prefer to leave it at that.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. Well, if we go back to a couple of the questions here, we still have a little question we haven't really answered, I think. And,
what's that?
It's the question of who is putting out new noses and who is not, and how can we validate that? And I was just thinking, in your own lives, do you feel you're putting out new noses?
Oh, certainly. I think we spoke about that a little bit indirectly right at the top of this program. Ryan and I working on, together with Liber 27, English Kabbalah, Liber Ged, our Enochian work, the Liber Loga that I've been translating, the Holy Table that Ryan and I co-translated.
How can I validate that it's the real stuff?
How can you validate that it's the real stuff? A good question. You can apply your own Kabbalistic insights, your own research into the history of religion, your own practical use of the material will lead you to accept or reject the material. I'm not so sure that new gnosis necessarily needs to be accepted by everybody, but I will say it does certainly need to be accepted on some communitarian level. I mean, Ryan comes along with Liber 27 one day, and for my own purposes, it seems right out of the blue. I didn't send Ryan a note. I didn't talk to Ryan and say, oh, you got to do something with my English Kabbalah. And Ryan just saw it and said, hey, this is interesting. Here, I could do something with this. And boom. And the next thing you know, Paul Thomas comes out and he's applying the same technique to the first verses of Liber Al in a very interesting way. And it's like, wow, that's the concept. Okay, it inspired creativity in other people.
Not only that, but you can you should be able to analyze it and find a degree of coherence Kabbalistically. Crowley did it with his Book of the Law, because we are dealing with magical gnosis on some level.
Yes.
So Crowley was able to add up several new numerical figures using the Kabbalistic practice of gematria, and noticed the key numbers repeating in connection to ideas which already seem to have a connection. Such as his name 666 and its connection with the Stele of Revealing and the Bulak Museum, whose number was 666, and the instructions he was given to go get that Stele. There are many other proofs. I don't have it all on me to go over it, but such as
that key Liber 31 becomes the key to the English Kabbalah that we come up with.
And is also the key to the Enochian table when I was shown an astral letter G making the sound ga, and then you look up the word ga in the Enochian dictionary, not knowing about this word at all when I scried it, and it means 31 in Enochian. And the angels told me that it was the key to the table. And not only that, when we translated the table, you get the ideas of Babylon and the beast coming out of it. which are also mentioned in Crowley's scrying of the 30 ethers in Enochiana, and which are directly and more indirectly referred to in the Book of the Law. So you get these correspondences that come up that make coherence. There should be coherence. That is a measure of truth. That it can be connected to on other planes and with other things into something that is meaningful.
Yeah, coherence provides symmetry, and beauty is always a key to knowledge. You know, it there must be a beauty to it. You know, and when you find all these things together, you find something erstwhile. So, you know, I look at it, I say, well, you know, I've spent some time building this lineage and the other orders around it in this AMHR umbrella, and I have now found several people that have been able to do beautiful things. And this is marvelous, because not only is it my work, but it's the work of others that are able to coincide and to build this interesting fortress. You know, in the meantime, I look at other lineages just rehashing the same old crap. You know, I mean, how many times can Duquette rewrite a book? How many times is Ray Yale's going to tell you, we do what Moda does and that's it? How many times is Eshelman going to try to convince somebody that his little mystical system of the AA book is somehow, an important piece of work, when all he did was copy down stuff and put it into a nice book that, you know, is useful. I've made great use of it. I like the book. But it does absolutely nothing.
But the other problem is they have their intentions messed up. They're putting the cart before the horse. Their main intention, it seems, is to make money. Which doesn't make any sense, because the occult is not the place to make money, first of all.
Yeah. The three of us that are into the occult, you know, around the world, and two of us are sitting there saying, well, I got all the secrets for you. Mail me a check for $29.95. It's postage in the hand.
Pay your...
Yeah, if they do have any gnosis, I wouldn't know about it, because I'm not willing to buy their books.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? The caliphate has shut me, taken two of my documents, one we've now found, somebody else got online somewhere else. Get ready, caliphate, it's coming, somebody else got it. And of course, Ray Eales puts his name on Black Lodge papers that Moda wrote, and he forces me to take them offline. These guys are shut-ups. They're denying gnosis to the world. They want money first.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with money, but the thing is it should come as a byproduct of your genius, and it may or may not come. The genius is the reward in and of itself. Again, I'll use my analogy of Tesla, because he's a figure of inspiration for me. He was ripped off again and again from people he went into partnerships with, and he never cared, because he always knew he had more inventions and more ideas where it came from.